America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And welcome to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270, toll-free across the United States, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. Our websites, if you want to drop into our live chat room, if you want to participate on our message board, if you want to participate in the blog over at airamerica.com. And also an article that I wrote based on the main riff that we did in the second hour of the program yesterday is up at the very top of commondreams.org. Let me recommend that. A great website, but I think, yeah, as the author of it, I suppose, it's a reasonably good take on what's going on in Iraq and how we should be responding to it, and with regard to 9/11 as well, which brings us to the topic for this hour that I really, for the day, in fact, I'd say, that we really need to be considering, and that is, how do we respond to terror tactics without being terrorized? Martha Stout is the author of a new book called The Paranoia Switch. Switch as in light switch. How terror rewires our brains and reshapes our behavior and how we can reclaim our courage. Martha Stout, Dr. Martha Stout, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Very glad to have you with us. I also wanted to commend you on your previous books, The Sociopath Next Door, The Ruthless Versus the Rest of Us, and there was another one that you wrote that I thought was very good.
The only one I've written was The Myth of Sanity. So.
The Myth of Sanity, that's right. I was thinking The Myth of Normalcy, but yeah, the Myth of Sanity. And so tell us, first of all, how does terror rewire our brains?
Well, terror rewires our brains the way any kind of traumatic experience does. It turns out that the brain records trauma in a way that's different from the way we record normal experience. A normal memory is something like Aunt Mary took me to the zoo. And we remember that in words and pictures, and those are integrated, and we can talk about that with other people and add memories of Aunt Mary to that memory, and it's an integrated whole. Traumatic memory or traumatic experience, it's as if it overwhelms the brain itself so that it doesn't record the memory in an integrated way. It records little flashes of sensation and image and so forth. These are not integrated together. They're just little flashes, and that's what I'm referring to as the paranoia switch that gets left in the brain. And later on, when things happen, they don't necessarily have to be as bad as the original trauma or even related to the original trauma. It gets set off, and we will often act in ways that we wouldn't act if we hadn't been traumatized.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, perhaps the worst part of all that is that we're not aware of that. Most people at this point, 6 years later, if you ask them, "Are you affected by 9/11?" they would probably say no.
Yeah, and this is really an adaptive thing. I mean, this is how in other times and places we learned that if you see a particular type of movement in the grass, look out because it might be a lion coming to get you, or that sound, that particular unusual sound, might be the python coming through the tree on its way to get you, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Well, not only is fear adapted like that, but the brain not responding, in a sense, is adaptive, because that means that if we see the tiger or whatever, we can run. We can behave as opposed to being overwhelmed.
Right. So how does – and by the way, I have for a long time believed actually have a high level of certainty that the constant replaying of the video of those planes hitting those buildings over and over and over and over again – was probably the major traumatization of the American people with regard to 9/11. What's your take on that?
Well, in fact, you're borne out by research which showed that there's a pretty direct correlation between how much television a person watched at that time and how anxious, depressed, and so forth that person got.
Right.
And so, certainly, today. I mean, today we're seeing it over and over again on television.
Yeah, I haven't watched TV today. I've got to avoid it. It's just
good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who wants to see that again? It's like, gee, here, have some more terror, have some more pain, have some.
Yes, exactly.
No thanks. Now, the British lived through a period of time, and you know, without discussing the morality or amorality or you know problems of the conflicts in Northern Ireland and its long history, you know, without taking sides on that, although I you know I have opinions about it, but just setting all that aside for the moment, the British you know I mean their prime minister almost got killed. They, you know, the IRA tried to blow up number 10 Downing Street. They had bombs were going off in the tube, bombs were going off in front of department stores, civilians were killed randomly. This went on for some 20 plus years, as I recall. The Germans had a similar situation with the Bader-Meinhof gang. In Italy, they had the same situation with the Red Brigades. In fact, they even kidnapped the former prime minister, Aldo Moro, as I recall his name was, stuck him in the trunk of a car where he died of suffocation. The other countries, in Spain, they've had the Basque separatists, ETA, you know, forever. I mean, you know, for at least since, you know, Franco's time. And I think going back before that, other countries have had internal insurgencies or even external forces that have, quote, terrorized them, end quote, or attempted to terrorize them. And yet the people of those countries, and I've been in, frankly, all of the countries that I just named during the times when those kinds of things were going on. I was also down in Colombia when the drug wars were going on. In fact, I was just a few blocks from a pizza parlor blew up. And for the people, life just kind of went on. I mean, people were not terrified by this, and the government didn't do these huge, I mean, they didn't have leaders of government that, we have a war on terror, and it wasn't hyped and amplified in the media, and it wasn't exploited for political gain, at least as far as I could tell. Is our experience with 9/11 uniquely different because of the way the Bush administration and because of the way our electronic media, principally TV, chose to respond to it?
Well, I'm not sure it is quite unique, but certainly it's in the minority, which is something that I think most Americans don't understand. Most people will ask me, for example, but wouldn't any country react the same way if they had been terrorized that way? And first of all, many countries have been terrorized. And secondly, no, countries don't always react that way. You know, a country, a nation will react differently, and sometimes the same nation will react differently at different times. And certainly the nations that have received major studies along those lines, England and Israel in particular, we find that certainly terror happens at the spot of the terror and people feel grief and loss. But as you say, life goes on. And, apparently the difference is that the people have time to take a deep breath because there's no, the people don't jump in, the politicians don't jump in and try to increase the fear or keep the fear up. And they have an opportunity to cope rationally, to be able to be fearful only if they find good reason to be fearful.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Martha Stout. She's the author of The Paranoia Switch, How Terror Rewires Our Brain and Reshapes Our Behavior, and How We Can Reclaim Our Courage. Dr. Stout, we only have a minute left. How do we reclaim our courage?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to realize that you are affected, that something happened on that day that affected you, even if you don't experience it that way at this point. And you need to be aware that you're vulnerable and that when you see these images over and over, or when politicians do tell you, be very frightened, somewhere in your brain you're going to react and you need to try to galvanize yourself against that. We also need to go back to being what we were as a nation and as individuals. You know, if you were someone who questioned things before, question them now. Protest them now if that's who you are. It's hard to remember what you were doing, how you were feeling before 2001, but try. We need to recover, like any trauma survivor, we need to rediscover who we were.
Yeah, we need to reclaim our courage. We need to say, we're not going to be afraid anymore, thank you very much. And we're going to move on with our lives. And even if there is another attack, we're not going to be afraid anymore. Martha Stout, her book, The Paranoia Switch, How Terror Rewires Our Brains, Reshapes Our Behavior, and How We Can Reclaim Our Courage. Dr. Stout, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, how have you reclaimed your courage? 866-303-2270.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Terror! Yeah, right. Petraeus, of course, testifying before Congress. General Petraeus. I have an op-ed about this over at commondreams.org. It's also been picked up on a bunch of other sites, opednews.com and whatnot. You can post your thoughts on those various blogs. There's a link to it from the articles to on democracy link off tomhartman.com. If you want to check it out. But there have been many times in our history, in the history of these United States, when people have attempted to terrorize us. The British attempted to terrorize us in 1776. They very much attempted to terrorize us. For example, on May 29th, 1780, the British Legion of Banstrey Tarleton charged into a battle. This, by the way, from Weird History 101 by John Richard Stevens, charged into a battle against a regiment of Virginia infantry under Colonel Abraham Buford. This is right on the border between the two Carolinas. Buford had about 400 men, but he was overrun by the British. So he says, surrender. The guy sticks up a white flag. The British shoot off the top of the flag. He tries to surrender. He and his 400 men, they try to surrender, and the British come in and they murder every single man. They kill all of them. Then a little later on in the war, a few weeks later, one Swedish officer named Carl Gustav Tornquist, who was serving with the French Navy in the area at the time, reported that at one beautiful estate, more or less, the floor of one room was covered. They were loaning us money for the war. Anyhow, the floor of one room was covered with the broken pieces of plaster figurines. This is what the British had done in a home. In the place of the plaster figurines were five human heads. This is what the British did to Americans during the Revolutionary War. While in a nearby room, and I'm quoting now from the Swedish officer who was here during the Revolutionary War, he said, while in a nearby room, a pregnant woman was found murdered in her bed through several bayonet stabs. The barbarians had opened both of her breasts and written above the bed canopy, thou shalt never give birth to a rebel. The baby that had been ripped from her womb was found outside hanging from a tree. This is how the British were dealing with us. And George Washington, General George Washington, instead of saying to the people, oh, we've got to be afraid, oh, we've got to do away with civil liberties, oh, we've got to, No, George Washington said, should any American soldier, this is his speech to the Northern Expeditionary Force on September 14th of 1775. This is even before the Declaration of Independence. He said, should any American soldier be so base and infamous as to injure any prisoner, I do most earnestly enjoin you to bring him to such severe and exemplary punishment as the enormity of the crime may require. Should it extend to death itself, it will not be disproportional to its guilt at such a time and in such a cause. For by such conduct, in other words, if American soldiers injure the prisoners that they take, by such conduct, that soldier shall have brought shame, disgrace, and ruin to ourselves and our country. On Christmas Day in 1776, during the Battle of Trenton, George Washington again said to his soldiers, treat them with humanity. He was talking about the hundreds of Hessian, of British mercenaries that had surrendered to his forces. He said to these were his instructions to his lieutenants. He said, treat them with humanity. Let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army. They were terrorizing us, and we said, no, we have values. We are going to stand up. Dolly Madison, this amazing story of Dolly Madison. August 24th, 1814. This was the day that the British attacked Washington, D.C. and sacked the White House. Now, a few weeks earlier, James Madison, who was then president of the United States, and a distant relative of mine, actually, had taken direct command of the armed forces of the United States. This, by the way, the only time in American history that a president actually took command of military forces. George Washington was not president during the Revolutionary War. He actually assumed the role of commander-in-chief. Dolly Madison wrote in her memoirs and letters about what it was like a year earlier. This is from May 12, 1813, a letter that she wrote to her husband's private secretary, Edward Coles. She said, and now if I could, I would describe to you the fears and alarms that circulate around me. For the last week, all the city and Georgetown have expected a visit from the enemy and were not lacking in their expressions of terror and reproach. Yesterday, an express announced the pause of a frigate at the mouth of the Potomac. The commander sent his boats to examine a Swedish ship that lay near, but our informer was too frightened to wait for further news. Get it? People were terrified. And she goes, talking about all this, and then she says, I therefore keep an old Tunisian saber within reach, right? She's waiting. She said, but I do not tremble at this, but feel hurt that the general should have sent me word that he would make his bow at my drawing room very shortly. In other words, she's saying, I'm not afraid. And I'm not going to be afraid. I'm not going to be terrorized by this. She said, these rogues are now 14 miles below Alexandria so that they may be on hand to burn the president's house. She's talking about her own house. Let me tell you what she said when the attack actually came. Right after this break, and then we'll take your calls. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Dreams. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dolly Madison, the wife of the, let's see, 4th president of the United States. The day before, the British and the Canadian, now they had seen this coming for a year. The day before the British attacked the White House, her home, her husband is gone. He's gone off to lead the troops in the battle. We're talking the War of 1812 here. You know, George Bush likes to say America's never been attacked on American soil before. Nonsense. Not only were we attacked during World War II, yes, we were. California, Oregon, and Washington states were all hit by Japanese submarines. The Bankline Oil Refinery in Glorieta and in Southern California was hit by 13 shells. Well, yeah, I can go on and on about that, but back to 1814. The day before the White House is seized by the British and burned, Dolly Madison, the first lady, her husband gone, he's off leading the troops in battle, literally, writes a letter to her sister Anna. She says, Dear Anna, my husband left me yesterday morning to join General Winder. He inquired anxiously whether I had courage or firmness to remain in the president's house, in the White House, until his return on the morrow or succeeding day. And on my assurance that I had no fear but for him and the success of our army, he left, beseeching me to take care of myself and of the cabinet papers, public and private. I have since received two dispatches from him written with a pencil. The last is alarming because he desires I should be ready at a moment's warning to enter my carriage and leave the city, that the enemy seemed stronger than had been first reported, and that it might happen that they would reach the city with the intention of destroying it. I am accordingly ready. I have pressed as many cabinet papers into trunks as to fill one carriage. Our private property must be sacrificed, as it is impossible to procure wagons for its transportation. I am determined not to go myself until I see Mr. Madison safe. She's talking about her husband. And this is how they wrote back then. So that he can accompany me, as I hear of much hostility toward him. Disaffection stalks around us. My friends and acquaintances are all gone, even Colonel C. with his 100, who were stationed as a guard in this enclosure. In other words, even the troops have fled the White House and immediate environs because they know the British are coming. And Dolly Madison is like, I'm going to stay. I'm not afraid. That was on Tuesday, August 23rd. Then the morning of Wednesday, August 24th, this is that afternoon, the British attacked. She writes again to her sister, since sunrise, I have been turning my spyglass in every direction and watching with unwearied anxiety, hoping to discover the approach of my dear husband and his friends. But alas, I can descry only groups of military wandering in all directions as if there was a lack of arms or of spirit to fight for their own fireside. That was in the morning. Then at 3 o'clock, Wednesday, 3 o'clock. Will you believe it, my sister? We have had a battle or skirmish near Blandensburg, and here I am, still within sound of the cannon. Mr. Madison comes not. May God protect us. Two messengers covered with dust come to bid me to fly, but here I mean to wait for him. Our kind friend Mr. Carroll has come to hasten my departure, and he is in a very bad humor with me because I insist on waiting until a large picture of General Washington is secured and it requires to be unscrewed from the wall. This process he found too tedious for these perilous moments. I had ordered the frame to be broken with an axe and the canvas taken out. It is done, and in the precious portrait placed in the hands of two gentlemen of New York for safekeeping. And now, dear sister, I must leave this house or the retreating army will make me a prisoner in it by filling up the road I am directed to take. When I shall again write to you, or where I shall be tomorrow, I cannot tell. Dolly. This is the First Lady of the United States, as the White House is about to be burned, saying, I'm not going to be afraid, damn it! Can't we learn something from our own history? 1-866-303-2270. Jane in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jane.
Hello.
Welcome. You're on the air.
This is Jane. Hi. Hi, Tom. You know, I want to tell you how much we love you and respect you and what you're doing. But my comment is answering your question about what we're doing. I never have been a person that lives in fear, although when I think about George W. Bush and the policies of the neocons, it could make me afraid if I didn't take action instead. Right now, today, I'm on my way to Seattle Center. There is a wonderful organization that was started and is sponsoring today's action called freedomfromfear.us. I believe it was a minister that started this, and also people from the World Can't Wait are running their orange campaign out of Seattle Center today to commemorate the death of so many millions in the world for more. Also to commemorate those who continue to suffer and die at the hands of these people that are making such horrible policy for our world.
Yep. Yeah, you know, got
Tom,
it. Well said, Jane.
Tom?
Yes.
I've often not called you before because I wanted to let other people talk. When I was growing up, people told me to be quiet all the time, but I refused to be quiet.
There you go.
I speak out in grocery stores and on the street and wherever I go, I wear my buttons and I speak out. I was on Mike Gravel's website this morning. I'm the poet on his website, on his blog website.
Well, I listed
what I think are the next steps to make change in America, and I added my voice along with all the rest of the wonderful voices that hope.
Good on you, Jane. That's what we need to do. We all need to be standing up and speaking out. And when you can take those emotions that the president is trying to peddle to us, that the Republicans are trying to sell to us of fear. Oh, we got to fight them there so they don't fight us here. They're coming to get us. When we take those emotions and convert them into action, fear goes away. And what it actually strengthens us. It builds us psychologically and emotionally. Pat in Evansdale, Indiana. Hey, Pat, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you very much. Your message of strength and courage is sorely needed today. The comment that I wanted to make, it had to do with your previous guest, was, you know, based on the response that the United States has on terrorism, I personally believe it's all market-driven. I mean, if you look at what happened after 9/11 with the stock market crashing, the airlines suffering greatly, you know, I think the response, whether it's eavesdropping or the message that's given out by the leadership of this country, is basically just to protect the economic base. I mean, why else would anybody be interested in eavesdropping and the things that they're doing? Yeah,
because they're trying to create an authoritarian fascist state.
But
I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what the Bushies are all about. They really don't believe in democracy. These guys really and truly believe that it, and you go back to the 60s. I mean, they all decried the 60s. That was the time when the middle class was the strongest in the history of this country. And what happened? Women started saying, we want rights. African Americans were saying, hey, what about those civil rights you promised us? Native Americans were speaking out, Russell Means and so on. Right across the board, because the middle class had economic power, it was demanding political power. And it frightened the elites. And these guys who think that what we need is essentially a fascist state, that it should be of, by, and for the elites, period, end of discussion, they're pushing back, and they're doing it by trying to convert this country from a democracy into essentially a fascist state. And I'm not going to have it, and I don't think most Americans are going to have it. And now the majority of Democrats are pushing back. Now even many Republicans are pushing back and saying, we don't need no stinking Patriot Act. We don't need sneaking peeks in the middle of the night. We don't need the president wiretapping everybody, including his political opponents. We don't need it. Of course you have, you know, reasonable policies that in a reasonable intelligence service. And I mean, obviously. But to terrorize your own people for political gain, I'm not going to go there. Ain't going to happen. Grace in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hey, Grace.
Hey, Tom. Oh, wow. Do I love your program? You're a breath of fresh air. And I want to thank you for that. I called you because I'm listening to all this fear. You know, we're addressing the issue of fear today. And, you know, the acronym false evidence appearing real. I had a catering company for 30 years, and when the trade centers went down, I had two lunch carts in the trade centers and five in the surrounding area. And so everything disappeared in a second. And I looked at what was in front of me, and instead of being frightened and terrified, what I did, because I had a lot of training in this, I said, well, I know what the universe is, and I know the truth of the universe. I know everything I need is here. And with that in mind, within 1 month, I had regained more than I had lost. Yeah. More.
Because you decided to stand up, take a deep breath, and start moving forward.
Yeah, because I looked around me, and I started relating to the people, and the energy that was there was just so phenomenal. I mean, I was helped in ways that I could not have imagined.
Yeah.
And so the point I want to make is that fear is something which we either accept and subscribe to, or we choose something different.
Yep, absolutely. Very well said. Thank you very much, Grace. As Franklin Roosevelt said,
let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And that retreat, the Bushies are still trying to sell us, the Republicans are still, and the media, the infotainment industry, right across the board. I mean, those with the obvious political agenda like faux news and even the mainstream media.
Oh, you know, fear itself, it'll get more eyeballs to the TV. Yeah, so let's do that.
I am not going to be afraid anymore. Thank you very much. And I think that increasingly, the majority of Americans are saying, we've had enough of being afraid. Sorry, guys.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
And the way out is to say, no, I am not going to be afraid. I'm sorry, I have been in Israel when bombs have gone off. I've been in Peru when bombs have gone off. I've been in Colombia when bombs have gone off. I've been in Uganda during a war. I'm telling you, it is possible for people to live in the midst of attempts at terror and not be terrorized and just say, you know, I'm sorry, not going to buy it. Not going to buy it. We are going to continue our lives. Ed in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom.
Ed, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I'm listening to the frame that's going around, and I think there's a little psychological flaw here. A lot of the people are saying we have a freedom from terrorism thing going on. It's impossible to have freedom from anything. What we have is a freedom to be brave. There's no such thing as a freedom from slavery. We have freedom to be free.
There
and
you
I
go.
Think
that's,
if you change
well
that frame around, it makes it a lot stronger, a lot more positive statement.
Well, look at how the British made it through World War II. Good point, Ed. Thank you. Look at how the British made it through World War II, being bombed during the Blitz. And there's some marvelous documentaries on how what the great efforts they went to make life normal, living down in the shelters, living down in the tubes. The old expression, stiff upper lip. We need that here. Eileen in New York City. Hey, Eileen.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I live downtown, not too far from the Trade Center. And for the first week or so after the attacks, it was like a war zone down here. You know, we had to pass through military checkpoints to get a quart of milk. We were cut off from all vehicular traffic except emergency. And there was a very palpable tension that something more was coming. Yet we had cops and firemen coming from all around the country and even the world to help us out. And their sense of bravery to put themselves at risk and the sacrifice that their families made, because they must have been very concerned for their safety, was a real source of inspiration.
Yep, and the ultimate tragedy is that they were lied to by the Bush administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, and Rudy Giuliani about the dangers that they were facing, which had nothing to do with terrorism, and everything to do with the Bush administration lying to them about the quality of the air. I mean,
that's correct. I'm so grateful to them for putting themselves in this jeopardy, when we didn't know the other jeopardy. And I made sure to thank every one of them and thank their families.
Yeah. Well done. Thank you, Eileen. Thanks for sharing that with us. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thank you. Thanks for playing that thing from Roosevelt, because that is so on point. Basically, what's going on is a couple of things from the military, at least the sayings. One is that panic prevents thought and action.
Yep.
And what we've been done, or what's been done, is we've been stampeding, and Bush continues to stampede us. And what we've got going on now with the one or two Osama types, I'm not sure which, and Bush is they're both keeping up the skier.
Oh yeah, and Bush and Bin Laden, they're doing the exact same dance from the opposite sides, and they're both feeding each other and helping each other, and all the worse for the rest of us, and we just have to say sorry, we're not buying your sales pitch anymore, and even if you blow up another city, we're not going to buy your sales pitch anymore, because we're Americans and we've been through hell in this country. We went through the hell of the Revolutionary War. We went through the hell of the War of 1812. We saw the White House actually burned in the War of 1812. We went through the hell of the Civil War. We've been through the hell of the Spanish-American War and the World War I and World War II and Vietnam. And sorry, you know, we know that we will endure. And now we're going through the hell of the Bush administration trying to deconstruct the Constitution of the United States. And this, too, shall pass because we're Americans and we're going to fight back and we're going to take back this country. Chris in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great.
You know, I've taken it upon myself to try and get the Democrats to get some spine to try and do something, because I'm going to fundraisers now and I am speaking out at the fundraisers directly to the people in the Congress and people who are working, raising money for them. And I'm telling them, if you don't do something, I'm going to stop your funds, you know?
Yeah.
And,
there you go. There you go.
And,
Enough already, we need to say. Yeah, absolutely. And people say, well, Congress, you know, they don't have 67 votes to overcome a presidential veto or 60 votes to stop a filibuster. No, all you need is 40 votes in the United States Senate to say no to a piece of legislation. They can just simply say, sorry, George, you got enough money in the Pentagon budget to pull our guys out of Iraq. You've got more than enough money, and that's it. That's all we're going to give you. Brad in South Dakota, got about a minute before we have to wrap up this hour. Brad, what's up?
Hey, listen, a lot of people stealing my thunder, which is a good thing. We're all on the same page. But I want to tell you, back in World War II, my aunt and a few children were the only people killed on U.S. soil by the Japanese with Japanese balloon bombs.
Yeah, exactly. In the Pacific Northwest.
The government kept this very quiet. Google Japanese balloon bombs and look up the Elsie Mitchell story. It'll tell you all about my aunt and how bad the government kept this under wraps.
Yeah, and it wasn't, by the way, that wasn't the only attack. I mean, there were a whole variety of them. On February 23rd, 1942, the Japanese submarine fired bombs at a refinery operation in Southern California. 13 bombs, 13 shells, and blew up an oil well. It was covered up, but, yeah, it happened. On June 21st, the Columbia River, Washington State, was shelled by a Japanese submarine. The next day, the military depot at Fort Stevens, Oregon, was shelled by a Japanese submarine. We have been attacked before. I mean, you know, obviously Pearl Harbor. It's time for us to say, enough. We're not going to buy the fear thing. We're not going to vote fear. We're not gonna proceed with fear. We're done with fear. Thank you very much. We're done with fear, and now we're gonna move forward and take this country back. And part of that is the thinking of brilliant people like Ralph Nader, who's coming up next. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, Ray McGovern was dragged out of the hearings before Congress because he was the former CIA officer. Because he was saying, why don't you guys swear in General Petraeus? Why don't you swear him in? Why, put him under oath. They dragged him out. Amazing. Moving along, Ralph Nader is with us. He's the author of The 17 Traditions, a consumer advocate, a lawyer. His website, Nader.org, the guy I voted for in the 2000 election. Ralph Nader, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm very, very glad to have you here with us. There's just a whole pile of issues on the table here, and I wanted to have a bit of an in-depth conversation with you today, if possible, on many of these issues that are facing the United States. Let's start, particularly given the day and you know what's going on, that you know 9/11 and everything, with the idea of fear. You in the 17 traditions in your book, I believe that you address at a certain level the importance of support networks and fearlessness. We are being terrorized by, it's in my opinion, by our own government. I'm just curious to get your take on all this.
Yeah, it's really reached new heights in American history. I mean, this book, 17 Traditions, about how my parents raised their four children. And, of course, it was in the 30s in the Depression, a lot of economic fear there. In World War II, with a lot of economic, wartime fears. But it was never like this. And I think what Bush has recognized, and the Republicans in particular, is that several political advantages accrue to spreading this politics of fear. First of all, he chills out the Democratic Party. He tends to depress dissent in the country. He diverts attention from the necessities of the American people. It's all about Iraq, terror. Just look at his speeches in the last few months. You'd think he was mayor of Baghdad instead of president of the United States, paying attention to worker, patient, health insurance, tax reform, you know, all these things that are way overdue. And he doesn't like to pay attention to these because that the next advantage is relevant to this point, which is this politics of fear have made billions of dollars for his corporate buddies, including Halliburton, Cheney's Halliburton, the oil companies. And they turn around, of course, and threw a couple hundred million dollars into his campaign in 2004. And then finally, the advantage to Bush is that he sucks authority and power out of the legislature and out of the courts. And, of course, Congress is perfectly willing to abandon its constitutional responsibilities and give him the power to declare war, the appropriations power, et cetera. So what's not to like from Bush's viewpoint? Now, this is extremely hazardous for a democratic society, Tom, because any politician can play this game in the White House, whether it's Democrat, Republican, and it illustrates the sinking weakness of our democratic system, where the people are being more and more shut out and more intimidated.
Yeah, and this is in many ways a repeat of and I realize it's probably an overblown analogy, but nonetheless I think it's a useful one, of what Hitler did with the Reichstag fire. You know, he labeled Marius von der Lubbe, the Dutch communist who was convicted of the fire, as a terrorist, and then used terrorism as a tool to subvert democracy in Germany.
Well, all authoritarian leaders or dictatorial leaders, take your pick, play that game. The outside threat, but Bush has played it to a level of a political virtuoso. I mean, all these advantages accruing to him at inestimable damage. And I must say, the Democrats let him get away with it. I mean, the Democrats could have stopped the war. They could have stopped the Patriot Act. They could have stopped the tax cut for the wealthy. Even now, they control the Congress, and they're, in effect, throwing their hands up and saying, unless we get a veto-proof 67 votes in the Senate, we can't do anything about ending a war that 70% of the American people want ended, as well as many other prominent retired military, intelligence, and diplomat officials.
Yeah, and James Madison, who served during a time of war, in fact, he actually is the only president to have led troops in the War of 1812, he said, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. And that's what these guys want to bring us.
And that's what Bush has designed the war on terror has no end. It's interesting, even when our country and Soviet Union were 30 minutes away from oblivion, from submarine or aircraft-based nuclear warheads and bombs, for over 25, 30 years, we didn't have this kind of politics of fear. And in fact, Douglas MacArthur in 1957 made a speech where he warned about government playing this politics of fear. There's a phrase in the Pentagon about this. It's called threat inflation. When you inflate the threat, you don't react to reality. You disproportionately react in a way that will increase the threat. So by invading Iraq, a country that didn't threaten us, we have massively expanded and recruited more and more of these young men coming in to learn the arts of sabotage and go back to their countries. And that was exactly what General Casey said in Iraq. That's exactly what J. Porter Goss, the head of the CIA, testified for Congress over 2 years ago. That's conventional wisdom. Our military presence in Iraq is expanding the terrorist threat.
Yeah, and now we've touched this before here. I mean, you had obviously Joe McCarthy, but perhaps even more to the point, in the 1970s, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney helped start something called the Committee for the Present Danger. This was in 72. Nixon came back from China a meeting with the Soviet Union, rather, and he said the era of fear is over, announcing detente. And this so horrified these guys that they created this organization, the Committee for a Present Danger, with the specific goal of launching an advertising and public relations campaign to re-terrify the American people.
How else do you have slightly over 50% of the entire federal government's operating budget? That doesn't count Social Security, insurance systems. Over 50% now is military budget and military-related budget. And we have no major enemy, no more Soviet Union. Communist China wants our industries and jobs. They're not going to hurl missiles at us. We're cooperating with both those countries, intelligence and all that. So what is all this F-22, more nuclear submarines, more this, more that, that was designed for a Soviet Union era of hostility? Why is it taking hundreds of billions of dollars away from clinics, public transit, libraries, schools, highways, all the infrastructure is crumbling in our country? That's the price we're paying in addition to the bloodshed over in Iraq. So it is the perfect menu for an authoritarian regime. And Bush and Cheney are the leading practitioners, and the Democrats have let them get away with it.
Yeah, this is to put the very worst possible face on it, this is an attempt to subvert the Constitution and fundamentally destroy America from within. This is the fifth column. Now, the flip side of that is that there are people like you and me and our listeners and a lot of actually noble politicians out there in both parties, not as many as we need, but still, nonetheless, the voices of dissent have not been silenced, who want to take this country back. What's your best hope for how we get through this, Ralph Nader?
Well, the best instrument is the Congress, and that means that if a couple thousand people in each congressional district created a Congress turnaround club or a Congress watchdog club with the intensity that some very faithful bird watchers perform their pleasures in bird watcher clubs, we could turn around 535 men and women in Congress who put their shoes on like everyone else does. And they have enormous power. They control the purse, the money, the taxes, the war declaration authority. That is the pivot that I've always believed can do that. They can impeach the president. These are the most impeachable president and vice presidents in American history. And Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid have taken it off the table. Well, that's like a go signal for these guys. Maybe, hey, they'll say they can invade Iraq or bomb Iran with impunity. So it really is key people organizing in each congressional district. It's not that big a deal. And focusing on central issues like health insurance, living wage, tax reform, waging peace, getting out of Iraq, and you'll see a tremendous difference, Tom. I mean, there's a huge vacuum out there back home where these senators and representatives really don't have to worry about any organized citizenry. They worry about insurance agents and oil companies and so on. But that's the big gap, and that's the matter people just don't seem to want to face.
Right. We need to organize politically. Just voting isn't enough. We're talking with Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, lawyer, former candidate for the United States presidency of the United States, and author of The 17 Traditions, his newest book, Nader.org, his website. And you can stick around with us. We can continue the conversation right after this break.
Sure.
Okay, great. We're talking with Ralph Nader, 16 minutes past the hour, on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The magic of democracy. I believe in that as much as I believe in the magic of love. Ralph Nader is with us, one of the most tireless and fearless advocates of democracy in the United States, consumer advocate, lawyer. His new book, The 17 Traditions, his website, Nader.org. Ralph Nader, I wanted to get your thoughts on the new attorney general. You wrote about this recently in an open letter to George W. Bush. And there's a lot of speculation about who it's going to be, although it seems that Ted Olson is bubbling up to the top, a guy who has a very, very checkered past. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I did write an open letter to Bush on August 30th. It's on Nader.org. And by the way, on the Iraq War, our group to end the Iraq War is democracyrising.us for your listeners, democracyrising.us.
Thank you.
Great. And in the letter to Bush, I urged him to recognize that the Attorney General has to have a certain level of independence and has to do more than swear to support the Constitution, but to uphold it. And in so doing, I raised all these questions about what Gonzales did and in terms of not telling the truth before Congress, listed them all, documented it, in order to try to lay a framework so that Bush doesn't just appoint another crony. Now, look how Bush is in the cockpit seat. He's appointed as a acting attorney general, a loyalist, Mr. Clement, who is the solicitor general. And now they say he might appoint Ted Olson. Well, let's say the Democrats don't like Ted Olson. Well, they don't confirm Ted Olson in the Senate. Well, Bush continues with his acting attorney general, Mr. Clement. So, again, Bush has the Congress over a barrel. And the reason is that the Democrats did not move quickly enough, even though they accused, and they had Republican support for this, they accused Gonzales of perjury repeatedly, to impeach Gonzales,
right.
As they did not move to impeach Bush or Cheney. So I don't see, Tom, any really independent attorney general operating here. Olson is smart. There's no doubt about it. He knows his way around Washington. He was a solicitor general. He is a corporate lawyer now, and he may well get confirmed. But either way, Bush is going to get his man, and attorney generals provide political cover when they're
Olson was one of the lawyers who helped put together the Bush v. Gore argument before the Supreme Court that made George Bush president.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, see, if there was an independent attorney general worthy of the word integrity, then a lot of the subpoenas would be responded to that Congress is sending, and a lot of the murky situations that involve violation of federal law and constitutional violations would be the object of Attorney General's professional mission, but Bush is taking no chances.
I'm curious about your take on the Democrats in Congress who are seemingly, you know, spineless, the ones who are going along with the administration, so many different things, from FISA to the war to et cetera, mounting primary challenges against incumbent Democrats in the House of Representatives. Every single member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election now. The conventional political wisdom is that when an incumbent is challenged in a primary, it weakens them and makes them vulnerable to losing the election, and we might end up with a whole lot more Republicans. On the other hand, there are many of us who are just fed up with a lot of these Democrats. What are your thoughts on how this should proceed?
My point is, once you're playing that game of least worst, you're going to get both worse. And, for example, right now, the Harry Reid, who is the majority leader in the Senate, Democrat, let through a provision in the energy bill by Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, setting up a $50 billion loan guarantee for the construction of new nuclear plants. So, in other words, the nuclear industry has been around 50 years, coddled, subsidized, corporate welfare. It can't do it on its own, and Wall Street will not finance a nuclear plant. Now, to show you what Wall Street thinks of nuclear plant economics and risks, they won't even finance 10% of the cost of a $4.5 billion nuclear plant without a guarantee. In other words,
and nobody will insure them without Price Anderson. I mean, you and I are insuring the nuclear plants because no insurance company will go near them.
Now the question is, are the Democrats going to exclude this provision in the conference on the energy bill between the House and the Senate? Well, that's up in the air. I mean, there's no end to the disappointment daily of these Democrats. And I must say, they have a large progressive caucus in the House that isn't standing up to its name. They have about 60 to 65 members of the House who are members of the Democratic Progressive Caucus and the African-American Black Caucus. They have about 45, many of them committee chairs with huge seniority. What are they waiting for? They got a president that's down to 28% in popularity. They got 70-80% poll numbers supporting. I suppose the answer is, I guess they're waiting for public financing of campaigns, because the only variable that seems to keep them disgraced is the money coming in from corporations into their campaigns.
Indeed. And that's really something that needs to be at the top of everybody's agenda, is public financing of campaigns. Ralph Nader, author of The 17 Traditions, Nader.org, his website. What was the anti-war website?
It's democracyrising.us. Get involved
Great.
On that. Get involved.
There you go. Thank you so much, Ralph Nader. Thank you for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. We deal in the dream of democracy in the United States of America, of fearlessness in the face of those who would want us to be terrified, those like Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush, the Republicans in the media who are trying to hype terror, terror, terror all the time. And we celebrate those who are fearless, those who subscribe to Franklin Roosevelt's strong and emphatic suggestion.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And we're celebrating the efforts and the work of those of our listeners, of those among us who are saying, no, we're not going to be afraid. And one of my heroes, one of the guys who's really out there doing it, is Ray McGovern, 27-year veteran of the CIA, spanned administrations from John Kennedy to George Herbert Walker Bush. He's now the co-director of the Servant Leadership School, which provides training and other support for those seeking ways to be in relationship with the marginalized poor. Most of his writings appear over at TomPaine.com or TruthOut.org. Ray McGovern, welcome to the program, Ray.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's always great to have you on. You stood up on Monday, yesterday, in the hearings before the House Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committees during that awkward 5 or 10 minute interval when Petraeus's microphone wasn't working, and shouted out, "Swear him in!" And tell us first of all why you said that.
Well, actually, it was rather naive on my part. It was a hiatus that you don't usually get at a hearing like that, and it struck me that the chairman, Ike Skelton, had asked Petraeus to begin his testimony without having him sworn in. And so I said, well, gee, he forgot that. But luckily, the microphone isn't working yet, so I looked around. Nobody else was thinking of it, so I just shouted out, the swear him in! And then
what happened?
Well, you could hear a pin drop. It was really quite amazing. And, a woman came down and she said, you really shouldn't do that. Better not do that anymore. I said, okay, I won't say anything anymore. Then two cops came and bodily extracted me from the area.
So let me get this straight. A man with 27 years of service to his country as a CIA analyst for saying something that was not obscene or not even, frankly, challenging. It was simply a suggestion. You get dragged out of this congressional hearing?
That's what happened, Tom. Yeah, I wasn't even interrupting anyone. Now, there was some interruption later on, and I have nothing but praise for people who stand up and try to point out what's really going on. But, I was not up interrupting anything, and I was really just trying to be helpful in my own way. What actually had gone through my mind, Tom, is I had remembered back in early 2006, there was this big buzz about Gonzalez and how he had approved these illegal eavesdropping programs, and Senator Spector, the head of the Judiciary Committee at the time, was going to have these hearings, and he had Gonzalez up there, and then he said, okay, we'll take your testimony, and Pat Leahy, the ranking Democrat, said, Senator Spector, you forgot to swear the witness in. And Spector said, I was watching this live, and Spector said, oh, no, we're not going to do that.
No.
In my view, the Democrats should have just walked out then, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but they didn't. They hung around. And here's Gonzalez, you know, what a precedent that is. And so I'm thinking, you know, wouldn't Petraeus want to be sworn in? I mean, if he's half as honest as everybody is protesting is, why not swear him in? But I suspect that some sort of deal was made where, you know, he was given extra assurance that he could sort of play fast and loose with the figures, as General Westmoreland did during Vietnam, and that there would be no consequences of the kind that Scooter Libby faced for committing perjury. It's really, really kind of, it's anger-inducing. And, you know, Tom, you may not know this, but while all this was going on, out in the hall, Cindy Sheehan and her sister Dee Dee were being cuffed and brought out to jail. And Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who is, he's a minister and he's president of the HIPAC caucus and very much an advocate of peace and so forth. He was next in line to get in, and they wouldn't let him in the hearing room. And so he tried to argue with the it's all on YouTube. He tried to explain that he was waiting for 3 hours, like to get in, like everybody else had before him, and the people after him started to get in. And you can see it on YouTube. 5 Capitol Police people just jump him, drag him to the ground, hurt his foot very badly. He was hospitalized before he was put in jail. I don't know where he is right now. But it's getting pretty ugly when that kind of thing happens.
It really and truly is, and it's and even uglier dimension of it is that none of this appeared in any of the press.
Is that right? I haven't.
I mean, that's yeah. I mean, I have to do this for a living. You know, I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, USA Today, and the local paper here, and you know, every day. And I have seen nothing about the things that you. I mean, you prefaced it by saying, Tom, you may not know this. I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm sure it's out there in the blogs. I read as many of them as I can as well. But it's just, I mean, there's only so many hours in the day. Ray, I'd like to ask you to put on your CIA analyst hat for a moment. You did this for a lot of years in service to our country, and share with me your thoughts on two issues. And I'm just going to give you very broad frames, and you can be as broad or as specific as you like.
Mm-hmm.
The first being the possibility that we are seeing the end of truly representative democracy in the United States and slipping into a severely authoritarian state in the United States. And not just the possibility, I mean, there's a large amount of reality to that so far. But, you know, what you think the future of that will be, I'm actually quite hopeful that we can recover from it. But I'd like to get your take on that, number one. And number two, the situation with regard to Iran. It seems to me that they have a whole marketing campaign in their back pocket. They're not going to roll it out until they get money for Iraq, which will probably happen in the next few weeks. And then they're going to roll this thing out, in my opinion. I'm curious about your take on these two issues.
Well, on the first, you know, I think, Tom, I share your optimism that we'll be able to make it through. I like to say that I depend on the good sense of the American people. However, over the last couple of years, I've been saying that, and the American people are malnourished on news, they're malnourished on facts, and they can be easily misled. So let's keep our fingers crossed. I guess my bottom line is we are the ones we've been waiting for. We're the ones that have to get out there. We're the ones that have to descend on our congressmen and senators and say, look, enough is enough. Let's prevent worse from happening. Now, on the Iranian thing, I'm scared stiff. You know, I try to be a dispassionate analyst still. But when I see the New York Times, you know, lead edit, I'm sorry, not the Times, but the Washington Post, which is sort of to our administration as Pravda was to the Kremlin back when I was analyzing Soviet affairs, you look at the Washington Post editorial section, which is the real culprit here. And 2 weeks ago, they were saying Iranians are killing American soldiers. Iran is at war with us. The very least we can do is slap them with the label of terrorist organizations, the Revolutionary Guards there. And, you know, we're going to have to really face up to this problem. Now, the president himself, a major speech, 28th of August, the 26th of August, 5 years previous, was when Vice President Cheney, quote, rolled out, end quote, the campaign for the attack on Iraq. Anyhow, the president is calling attention to this terrible danger from Iran. Now, let me just focus in on one thing, which not many people know. There is a national intelligence estimate on how soon Iran can get a nuclear weapon. Big question, right? Okay.
Yeah. Assuming that they're actually trying to do that. I mean, they're asserting that they're just trying to enrich uranium so that they can use the reactors that we helped them build some 30 years ago.
All I can tell you is that the IAEA continues to say that despite all their inspections, they find no incontrovertible evidence that the processing such as is taking place is specifically designed for nuclear weapon. Do I think that they would want to do that option? Of course, they'd be idiots not to. They're one of the axes of evil, right? I mean, look what happened to the country that didn't have a nuclear weapon, Iraq.
Right.
Look what didn't happen to Korea, okay?
Yep.
So, yeah, so I'm very troubled when the president makes a case for going after Iran, not so much now, and this is a sort of more than a subtle distinction. If you look at his speech very carefully, he backed off the claim that the Iranians have announced that they want a nuclear weapon, which was false when he made it, and he backed off the claim that they're actively pursuing a nuclear weapon. He said they're pursuing the technology that could lead to a nuclear weapon. Subjunctive voice. Very, very interesting, okay? So why should
we heard this in Iraq, too.
We should get them because of what they're doing in Iraq. That's the deal.
Yeah. And we heard the same kind of language about, well, if they don't have weapons of mass destruction, they had the capability of coming up with it because they had somebody in the country who knew how to make one.
You got it.
Amazing. Ray McGovern, thank you for your service, Ray, and thanks for being on our program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
The time, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Ellen Radner on the line with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm actually standing right outside the Senate hearings, the Petraeus hearings, with two people from Code Pink. Before you talk to them, I just want to say that it was interesting. Two senators, one a Republican, I'm blocking on his name, you know, from Iowa, the guy's not running anymore, and Senator Dodd said that 60% of Iraqis believe that the surge has hindered reconciliation. And this is very interesting because, of course, and it was Senator Hagel, of course, and today Tony Snow was talking about how the surge had really helped reconciliation. I was just about to ask Tony about this, and then the briefing got called. And also, Senator Boxer said today that the surge was not compatible with the former view of General Petraeus, who basically said it was important that we not be seen as occupiers. So that's, if I had to sort of sum up some of what the hearings were this morning, that's pretty much where I think, that, you know, there's a lot of things that are contradictory, but those are two of the most interesting. And with that, I'm going to put on two Code Pink people who are standing right outside the hearing room with me at this point.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, Tom. It's Joan Stallard from Washington, D.C., Code Pink.
Hello, Joan. And what is Code Pink doing with regard to these hearings?
Code Pink is enormously interested in the hearing. We are following what is being said very closely. We are talking with our coalition members about what we find accurate about what's being said and what we find is not accurate. I think some of the figures are in disagreement, but mostly to me it's the lack of passion, the lack of emphasis on the huge volume of deaths in Iraq and the huge disturbance in daily life and the fear that people live in all the time. And we're talking about money and we're talking about selling them arms and how happy everyone is in Petraeus and that we're selling the Iraqis arms. It's just fabulous.
Yeah, with 180,000 weapon, you know, AK-47s missing. Incredible.
Now, the other thing I'm seem to be remarking on is the word reconciliation just seems to have, you know, lifted its head up out of the vocabulary, and everybody's just thinking reconciliation is wonderful after we've just spent 6 years talking about Sunni and Shia and Kurd, and they're against this and they're against that, and now all of a sudden we're talking about reconciliation. I find that very ironic, and nobody's saying a single word about the Iraqi Oil Workers Union and their whole enormous coalition that is desperate to bring Iraqis together. And I'm going to give you to Midge Potts now. And
okay,
have a
thank you. No, that's fine.
Oh, hello. This is Midge.
Hello,
Potts.
Mitch. Hey, by the way, Mitch, I understand my friend Medea Benjamin is in jail right now.
Several people, of course, were arrested yesterday, and there's a really good clip of Medea going to jail on MSNBC's website. And she was held overnight because they said she had a pending trial, and so about half the people of Code Pink got out last night, and Medea and Desiree and Lori Perdue all stayed in jail all night, and Colonel Ann Wright went to jail this morning during this part of the hearing on the Senate side.
David
Barrows, yeah.
And Ray McGovern got hauled out. We were just talking with Ray a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. It's like anti-American activity being played out in the back and anti-American activity being played out in the front with General Petraeus.
Uh-huh. Well, the blogs have been lit up with people saying that it's inappropriate for people to speak out during these hearings and that we should let the record hear what General Petraeus has to say. And in defense of that, I just want to say that it's very important to get General Petraeus' statement on the record, especially since it appears to be a pack of lies based on GAO report and other reports. But it's equally important to get this dissent on the record, even in a place that's as sacred as the Senate or the House of Representatives. The public record will show forever that there were voices in America that weren't just representing themselves. Medea wasn't just screaming her own opinion. There's millions and millions of Americans that are so sickened by this continued occupation that we feel like we have no choice but to make sure that the public record and that history shows there was a voice of dissent in this time.
Yeah. Indeed, and indeed there was. And by the way, the website for anybody interested, CodePinkDigit4Peace.org. CodePinkFor Peace.org.
CodePinkAlert.org, too, is our primary one now. So thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, good talking with you. You pass me back to Ellen?
Yes,
yeah.
Here we go.
Okay, we have about a minute here to wrap it up, Ellen.
I just want to also say that, first of all, it's great that older Americans are giving their time here. But secondly, Senator Kerry was really quite vocal this morning talking about why not hold Maliki up to the standards that he had been the one that had actually declared, and that he'd been the one that set the standards, and we're not even holding him up to his own standards. The other thing, I was also at the White House briefing today. I've been quite a few places today. And today, Helen Thomas asked about Iraq and whether the president had a right to just go attack, I'm sorry, not Iraq, Iran, whether the president had a right to attack Iran. And Tony Snow just completely blew that off this morning, saying that it was a hypothetical question.
Yeah, yeah. Did Hitler have a right to attack Poland? It's a hypothetical. Okay, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. And thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
And please pass our thanks along to the Code Pink people as well. The Tom Hartman Program. Thank you. Tom Hartman Program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Larry Johnson on the line with us, former Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. State Department officer with the Department of Counterterrorism. He's an expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis, and risk management. His website, NoQuarterUSA.net. Larry Johnson, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon.
Larry, great to have you with us. There's a bunch of things I want to talk about. One of the first is, this was on your blog last week, as I recall, toward the end of the week, and I discussed it on the air, and you and I have talked about it in email and in back channel a little bit, and that is either the accidental moving or the repositioning of nuclear missiles via B-52s here in the United States. What's your latest thinking on this?
It's no accident. In fact, I had another conversation with my buddy. I used a name from the movie Dr. Strangelove to mask his identity, but Jack D. Ripper. But my friend is a retired colonel, Air Force colonel, flew B-52s. And he actually gave me some additional information, which just further reinforced it. He said he's been thinking about it since our last conversation. He says there's absolutely no way this was an accident. But he says it just doesn't happen that way because of how those weapon systems are controlled. It's not like they're laying about out in a pile and somebody gets confused. And he said, in fact, to this day, even though he's been retired now for 8 years, 9 years, he still carries the serial numbers of the nuclear weapons that he carried because he said there can always come a question about the chain of custody and what happened to these weapon systems when they were in your custody, and he's kept them to this day. So that's how that is how thorough the training is for these Air Force officers with respect to these weapon systems.
Yeah. Now, so the bottom line here is you were suggesting that these nuclear weapons these are essentially tactical nuclear weapons. These aren't multi-megaton, you know, nuclear bombs like we have on the missiles that used to point at the Soviet
Correct.
Union. These are in the kiloton range, the thousands of tons of TNT equivalent rather than millions of tons. And could be used, essentially, you know, nuclear bunker busters. And you were suggesting that they were being moved from one Air Force base where they were being stored to another Air Force base that happens to be the staging point for transporting things over to the Middle East. Is that still
correct? Well, I mean, there are just some certain basic facts. Fact number one. Barksdale Air Force Base is the base from which U.S. B-52s stage operations in the Middle East. That's number one. Number two.
And that's where they ended up.
Number two. A B-52 taking off from a B-52 base in Minot, North Dakota, and landing at a B-52 base in Barksdale, Louisiana, shouldn't attract any attention at all because it's just common. It's like, as I said in my post, it's like watching a letter carrier walk out of a post office wearing a mail uniform. That's what happens there. But the fact that and you could not even look at a plane and readily see that, they're carrying nuclear weapons. You can't see that from just a casual observation. What this means is that somebody on the inside leaked it, and the leak, one of two logical conclusions. Either it was a deliberate leak, somebody was alarmed by what they were seeing, and they were trying to get the word out to Americans. The other alternative is this was part of an ongoing psychological operations campaign directed against Iran to flex our muscles and let them know, hey, we've got nukes, so don't mess with us.
A third option is that it was a trial balloon. They were trying to get out into the public discussion sphere the possibility that they were thinking of using nukes in Iran just to see if there was a firestorm of protest in Congress and in the media or not.
Right. I think that's also logical.
Is what happened.
He just said there's no way that this was a, quote, a mistake. They're trying to say, oh, they got confused, this was a mistake. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
Well, and these nuclear weapons have not been repositioned back to Minot, have they?
No. To my knowledge, they haven't said, oh, what? We got to get those over to Texas where we're decommissioning them.
So,
you know, it'd be one thing if that was the only part of this ramp-up for a military operation in Iran we were looking at. But there are other warning signs out there. The U.S. military operations directed against Iran have intensified since January. President Bush has acknowledged that they're conducting that, and you've seen David Petraeus and Ryan Crocker both testify to the fact that they're targeting Iranians aggressively inside Iraq of all shades and types. Secondly, the Central Intelligence Agency has dramatically increased its personnel and its activity in this regard. And then you have the additional deployment of U.S. ships to the area. So this is not an isolated act. This is part of a broader strategy right now to try to confront Iran. And I fear that it can lead to a miscalculation. And there are some who are actively pushing for military strikes.
Yeah, and my guess is that we will see the PR campaign for that roll out as soon as they've got another $50 billion for Iraq under their belts.
Well, you've already seen it this yesterday and today with David Petraeus, where they're just putting inordinate emphasis on the amount of activity and influence of Iran in Iraq. And yet, you know, the real irony is Iran's influence is fairly significant in southern Iraq, where the British are withdrawing, and yet we're not talking about putting more U.S. troops down there to deal with that.
Yeah,
so,
well, and the
mean,
other thing
it's
is...
It's so inconsistent, it's just... Insane.
Right, and the other thing is that the major Iranian influence, at least that I've been seeing reported both in the press, in the mainstream press and in the non-mainstream press, is that Iran is it's economic. I mean, Iran is opening banks, they're sending trade delegations, the Prime Minister of Iraq goes up to Iran and hangs out with Ahmadinejad, and Iranians are going down to Iraq. I mean, it sounds like two countries that are preparing for normalization of relations.
No, absolutely, and when you look at the people like Abdulaziz Al-Hakim, who was sitting in the Oval Office with George Bush just last December, you know, very close ties to Iran. Iran has, you know, the focus of their policy right now with respect to Iraq is they don't have to use military force because they are winning the day without military force.
Right.
You know, the use of military force makes sense when you don't have many other options. But
and frankly, my guess is that Iran is not all that interested in occupying, in quotes, Iraq. They just want to have good relations with a neighbor.
Well, I think they have a much more strategic focus on it. I mean, you know, if you looked at Iran the way we would look at Mexico and Canada, if they were both potentially hostile nations and we had fought an 8-year war with Canada or Mexico,
Well, this was true of Mexico in the last century,
in
the later part of the 19th century.
I mean, you know, the Mexicans still look at us with a little bit of the hairy eyeball because of that war. But the fact of the matter is Iran is trying to secure its borders and trying to ensure that whatever activities go on in those neighboring countries or activities are going to work in its favor. I understand.
Yeah, I mean, they lost a million men in that war against Iraq. They certainly don't want a repeat of that. You have a post, I believe it was published in Current Affairs. It's over at your blog. We're talking with Larry Johnson, by the way, former Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. State Department officer. His website, noquarterusa.net. And you have a post over there called "The Dave Petraeus and the Iraq Kabuki." Give us a snapshot of this here.
Well, you know, the bottom line is this theater that's going on today and yesterday up on the Hill is really not going to make much difference because the reality is we've hit the high water mark with U.S. troops. U.S. troops are going to start being pulled out. And it's really not going to happen that any member of Congress is going to say, okay, let's pull all U.S. troops out. We're going to be moving U.S. troops out next summer. The real question that needs to be asked is, what kind of relationship are we going to have with Iraq, and how does it serve U.S. interests? I mean, my attitude with foreign policy is, you've got to make sure it works in your interests, and if you can find a, you know, win-win situation, even better. But, you know, fighting over troop levels right now I think is a little silly, because the fact of the matter is that they're coming out regardless of what happens right now, unless we go to war with Iran. I think that's the one caveat that could end up changing that equation.
Yeah, and any sense of when that may happen, if it happens?
If it happens, it would be, I think, before February of next year. Because once you get past February, then you're so far into the political year and the presidential campaign that there would be, I think, even enormous pushback by Republican candidates at that point. Nonetheless, we're seeing clearly a propaganda effort on the part of this administration in the same way they sold the war and the cause of war in Iraq. They're trying to do the same thing with respect to Iran. And I say, you know, foolish ones, okay, shame on us. And fool me, you can't fool me again, as George Bush said. But
but he's going to do his best. I mean, you know, you can see all the PR pieces in place, all of the, you know, it's kind of leaking out around the edges. They haven't started the full court press yet, but I'm just waiting. It's coming any day now.
Well, I think that's why it's important that people be informed and push back and talk to their elected representatives.
Right, preemptively.
Yes, sir.
Larry Johnson, noquarterusa.net is website. Check it out. A great blog over there. Larry, thanks for staying with us.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure, man.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up next, Charlie Brown taking on Congressman Doolittle in California's 4th District, our Taking Back America segment.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my.
Yes, indeed. We're taking our country back here, and one of the folks right on the front lines of this, Charlie Brown. He's running against Congressman Doolittle in California's 4th District. Charlie has a distinguished 26-year Air Force career, during which he was involved in every U.S. military conflict from Vietnam to Desert Storm. In 2006, he came within 9,000 votes, 3% of defeating incumbent John Doolittle. In April, Doolittle had his home raided by the FBI. No big help for his campaign. Charlie Brown for Congress, forcongress.org, the website. Charlie Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning to most of your listeners. Good afternoon to some of them also.
There you go. Thank you. Charlie, what are the, and in fact, as I recall, we had you on just before the 2006 election as well for a similar segment. And what do you see as the primary defining issues that separate you from Congressman John Doolittle?
Well, it's the defining issues that separate me from a variety of people back in Congress, and it's the military background of we need some results in this country, and we don't have any results coming out of John Doolittle. We don't have any results coming out of this administration. 6 years since 9/11, we don't have border security. We don't have energy independence. We don't have bin Laden. They don't even admit that global warming climate change is real. Our economy, wages for most of us are stagnant. We just don't see any results. We got this partisanship that started 6 years ago that's splitting this country apart, and we need to start thinking about what's right for the country and how we're going to come together again to solve these problems.
Yeah, well said. Charlie, California's 4th District, what is that primary area?
4th District starts just east of Sacramento, take a line up to Lake Tahoe, go north to the Oregon border, the whole northeast corner of California, some of the most beautiful areas in the country up around Lake Tahoe and the other areas when they're not on fire, which John Doolittle's voted against funding the Forest Service to do something about the fires out here.
Yeah. So what advice would you have for any of our listeners who might be thinking about running for political office or who want to get involved by supporting somebody like yourself who is running against an incumbent Republican or, for that matter, in a primary who might be running against a weak incumbent Democrat?
Get involved with the local activists in your area. Find out who is actually doing something for the country. Talk is cheap. We've heard an awful lot of that from John Doolittle and others. What we need now are people that are taking action, that are out there talking to the people in the district, that are doing something for the people of the district. One of the points we'd like to make, and we're going to give 5% of our campaign contributions to veterans charities, because we've got all this talk coming out of Washington about supporting the troops and taking care of the veterans, and they're not. We've got a veterans club out here at local college where the veterans need help. So we're going to step up and give part of the political contributions to veterans in the area. If we could get every politician in the country to put their money where their mouth is about supporting the troops and the veterans, we could make a tremendous impact on the homeless. 1 in 3 homeless in this country are veterans. It's just the tip of the whole series of social problems we've got here. So let's have the politicians actually take some action to do something.
What? How did you get into this process, Charlie Brown?
I got recruited essentially by some veterans and friends. I was not politically active. I was not recruited by any major party. My wife and I started attending local political organizations because we were unhappy with what was going on in the country. We attended a lot of club meetings, a lot of activist meetings from Democracy for America through local Democratic clubs, peace groups, militant groups, every group we could find to see who is actually doing something to make change, reaching out to people to find solutions to problems. And
yeah,
that got us going into, well, let's step up and do it.
Yeah, indeed. And we have just 1 minute left, Charlie Brown. What do you think, what's your advice for people who want to move the Democratic Party right now in a more activist direction, to be holding the Republican? For example, there, it was just announced that they're going to postpone the decision about whether to hold this administration in contempt of Congress on actually on a variety of things. But as I recall, it was the Myers and Bolton testimony and the refusal to deliver papers and things that had to do with that. And they just decided that they're going to, you know, Nancy Pelosi, well, we'll wait a few weeks. Today was the deadline. How do we push these guys?
You keep writing and talking to your congressmen and women. You do not give up on the ones who are in there trying right now. We need more votes in Congress. We got to be realistic about this. We have to hold folks accountable, but at the same time, we have to give them the tools that make this doable. That's why I'm running for office, to be one more vote in there, being active. So let's get active and elect a few more people so we got the majority to have the votes to actually get it done.
Well said. Charlie Brown for forcongress.org. Charlie Brown for Congress.org, the website if you want to help him out. Charlie Brown, good luck against Congressman Doolittle, and thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Tom. I look forward to talking to you again in the next year, 14 months.
Thank you. You will. 27 minutes past
this. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's right.
Four minutes past the hour, and it's getting crazier and crazier out there. I gotta tell you, it's getting very strange. Well, in Minnesota anyway. This is about Minnesota. This is from the Associated Press. Police in Minnesota say a man who robbed a woman of her keys and cell phone then took off her shoes and licked her toes. Commander Kevin Casper says the 24-year-old woman was leaving work around 1 a.m. Saturday when a 27-year-old suspect approached her, demanded her keys and phone. After that, he removed her shoes. Police say the woman was not hurt. They arrested the man a few minutes later, about four blocks away. The woman identified the suspect, and police were able to recover the keys and phone. And the man was in custody, and it's not clear whether or not he's been formally charged or put in Larry Craig's custody. That latter part I added, actually. Raises some interesting questions. Was she tapping her foot? Was this at the airport in Minneapolis? Is this something in the water in Minnesota? We not only have the smartest listeners in Minnesota, but I'll tell you, passing through that state, you've got some of the strangest folks. It's a badge of honor. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. You want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message board, AirAmerica.com, if you want to participate in our blog. Got an article up today on CommonDreams.org as well you may want to check out. I think it's a pretty good one. And apropos of everything that's going on right now in congressional testimony and the like. And I believe that Ellen Ratner is going to be with us in just a moment. I think she's talking to Lauren right at the second about some very, very strange stuff. Yeah, there she is. Ellen. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, well, I'm sorry that you got blessed with me twice today. But...
Oh, it's a blessing. It really is. Thank you for calling back. I got this email from you, and I had to reply saying, call in and tell our listeners this story.
Well,
this is incredible.
Is I went and I picked up this map that Petraeus gave out to everybody called Major Threats to Iraq. And on the Iran side, it says there's little blue arrows, and it says lethal aid, training, and funding.
Then right now, Iran is one of Iraq's neighbors. Syria is one of its neighbors. Turkey is one of its neighbors, and Saudi Arabia. These are the four countries that border.
Exactly.
Okay, so by Iran, it says major. Okay.
But at the top of the map says PKK, which is, of course, a group that really does give Turkey a little grief. And then under Syria, it says foreign fighter flow. Okay, and it has three little arrows into the Anbar province and actually the upper part of Iraq as well. Saudi Arabia, it says nothing.
And yet 50% of all the foreign fighters captured in Iraq so far have been Saudis. The Saudis have been raising money to send to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. It was Osama bin Laden is a Saudi. Al-Qaeda originated out of Saudi Arabia. 17 of the hijackers who 14 of the 17 hijackers who hit the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were Saudi citizens.
And to give the Saudi government some credit here, they're not very happy about this situation. But to look at a map like this and to say that there is no major threat to Iraq coming from the area of Saudi Arabia is just, I felt like I was in a Mad Magazine cartoon.
That's absolutely incredible. This is Petraeus sucking up to the Bush administration, in my opinion. Do you think that this has to do with the close personal relationship that the Bush family has with the Saudi royal family, which has transferred over $1 billion worth of assets into various Bush family-controlled entities over the last 35 years?
I mean, clearly, you don't want to make the Saudi Arabian government mad. I mean, we get a lot of oil from them, and they have been very helpful in many respects on the terrorism war. I mean, there's also the Bush connection, et cetera. But, I mean, it's a mixed bag, and it's not one or the other. But to say that there is no threat coming from there or to not put it on the map is just, I mean, did the guy just cook it up in the middle of the night and say, okay, I'm just going to wipe it off the map, which is what it did, what they did.
Yeah. Yeah,
they just
amazing.
Completely wiped off any threat to Iraq off this map. It is
amazing.
Beyond anything I have ever seen. I'm beyond about it.
Okay. Well, Ellen, thank you very much for calling in and sharing that with us. I really appreciate it when you give us these little breaking insights. I really and truly do. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good talking with you, and I'll let you get back to the hearing and you know, keep us up to date on what's going on. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Our number, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Scott, Newport Beach, California. Hey, Scott, you want to disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
I don't necessarily want to disagree with you, Mr. Hartman. I have great respect for your program and your information you give out. I am a registered Republican here in Orange County, and it angers me when I hear you, the far left of the Democratic Party, come out. It's just as bad as the far right of the Republican Party come out and call a general a betrayer, a liar. The fact is, most of the Saudis that are coming there are not coming over the Saudi border. They're coming over from Syria. So, I mean,
how do you know that?
Well,
the Saudi border is much larger than the Syrian border,
it's
and it's
larger,
absolutely unprotected.
They're that's an opinion. But,
of course, a lot of it is desert, actually. I mean, maybe that they're coming through Syria because they fly into Syria, and it's just an easier border to cross. But the fact of the matter is they're coming from Saudi Arabia.
There's a lot of disgruntled Saudi. If you're disgruntled Saudi, I mean, I'm not going to sit there and defend the Saudi government because, I mean, they are. That's another subject. But my point being is that this coming election is very important. I voted for George Bush twice, and I'm sorry about it, and I apologize for it. But I mean, the Democrats lost the election. And they lost, for poor logistics. And the far left of the Democratic Party, like MoveOn.org, takes a full page out in the LA Times and the New York Times, calling them betrayers. Generals don't do that. They don't set policy. Politicians set policy. Generals
Bush has continuously, now for several years, said that he is going to allow the generals to set the policy. I mean, there was a very, very good op-ed piece in the Financial Times of London about five, 6 days ago saying this is a danger to democracy itself.
Starting with an ex-general who spoke in front of the United Nations, you know, you do what you're told, and he quit over that. And other generals, I mean, if you notice, there's been a high turnover of generals in the Pentagon and have been involved with this thing. These generals don't necessarily agree, but they don't set policy. They do.
No, but they do tell the truth. And this is you have, as you correctly pointed out, there has been a number of these generals who have said, I am not going to be a part of this thing. It is wrong. And they've quit. And some of them have lost pensions and other things. And Petraeus will not do that. Petraeus has gotten 2 stars under George W. Bush for his sucking up to him.
Yeah, well, the fact is, I don't believe the generals lie. And I think that when you sit there and call generals, I mean, they give their best assessment. You have your opinion. I don't think that Tom Hartman lies. I think.
But when Petraeus says that, I mean, he's, okay, he's not lying. He's, what's the old saying? Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. He's pointing out that, first of all, back in January, he said, and this was in his confirmation hearings, he said that there were some very, very good signs in Anbar province because some of the sheikhs were now coming to us and saying that they would like to take over security for Anbar province and stop shooting at us and instead settle things down. He said that that's a great thing. Now, that is what has been responsible for the majority of the reduction of violence in Iraq that has happened in the last 6 months. That and that alone. It's got nothing to do with any so-called surge or escalation or whatever you want to call it. And yet yesterday he testified before Congress, not under oath, by the way, that back in January he could not have anticipated that there would have been a reduction in violence in Anbar province. He contradicted himself. He lied.
Well, like you said, I don't believe that generals lie.
But he just did yesterday, on the record.
When the far left of the Democratic Party steps out and says, this is the way it is, he's a liar.
No, I'm just telling you what's on the record, what's on the congressional record. And by the way, I disagree with your characterization of me and the people who are opposed to this war as the far left. The majority of Americans want us out of Iraq. The majority of Americans want a national health care program. The majority of Americans would like to join a union. That is not far left. That's the mainstream position of America right now. I know that the far right likes to characterize that as the far left, far left is the old Communist Party of the USA that wants to nationalize every business in this country, and they are totally, totally marginalized.
How would you categorize MoveOn.org?
I would say that MoveOn.org is the points of view that they are taking, when you look at polls, represent more than 50% of Americans, and I defy you to find one position that they've taken that doesn't.
Well, I think that the Democratic Party, I mean, Mr. Herman, I listen to your program. I go one way or the other, you know. But it frightens me. I would like to see a Democrat. I would like to see change in the White House. I mean, we're going the wrong way. But if you want to blow the election,
If you look back at the last elections, and I realize this isn't the message that came out of the media, but if you look back at the last election, the 2006 election, those Democrats who ran as open progressives, taking the kind of positions that I take on this show, were the ones that, with the smallest amount of money, won the largest margins. You know, in Montana, you've got Brian Schweitzer, arguably the most progressive governor in the entire United States, taking a red state by storm. You got Bernie Sanders winning in huge margins in parts of Vermont that voted for Bush for twice in a row, and he's been winning there for 20 years. I mean, the progressive Democrats are the ones who are winning, and frankly, I think that if we want the Democratic Party to have electoral victories, we need to let them be Democrats rather than telling them that they need to be Republican light. Scott, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. I appreciate your tone. It's very well done.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
All that said,
higher and higher, baby.
Indeed. All that said, I don't speak for MoveOn.org, nor do they speak for me. What can I say? But again, I think it's crazy. You look at so-called mainstream TV, and it's like Tim Russert having on last Sunday having the guy from Pat Robertson's 700 Club as a serious commentator about Democratic candidates, and he's not referring to the guy as a far righty, but they refer to MoveOn.org as the far left blog or the far left web group. You know, come on. Tim in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, no, just a real quick one, man. You know, I was sitting there listening to your radio show, and some guy calls in and says that generals don't lie. You know, it really speaks well to where we're at in this nation that, you know, there's still people drinking the Kool-Aid. I'm from Minnesota, and by the way, there is something in the water here. But I think it's all over this nation. It's all over this nation.
Yeah,
I can't
right.
believe some of the comments.
Well, it's like Westmoreland during Vietnam, you know, when William S. Westmoreland was sucking up to the president, and he goes on, you know, he goes and testifies before Congress. Everything's fine. We're doing great. We're killing more of the enemy. Well, you know, actually, here's one way to look at it, Tim. If you're only looking at a military solution, if you think that the only answer to the thing is how many people can we kill and how many things can we blow up, because that's what the military does, then the general's saying, well, we're killing more people or we're not killing more people and we're blowing more stuff up or we're not blowing more stuff up. That, you know, might have some relevance. But the fact of the matter is in Iraq, it is not going to be a military solution that's going to put that country back together. They need water. They need electricity. They need jobs. They need civil governance. They need their hospitals to be rebuilt. Two-thirds of their doctors have left. Virtually all of the upper middle class and the wealthy people in the country have left. Their tax base has been wiped out. We imposed a flat 15% tax on them in some sort of weird neocon experiment. We brought multinational corporations in. We did away with laws that define illegal immigrants. So now all these multinational corporations are bringing in what here in the United States we call illegal immigrants. They're bringing in Bangladeshis and people from Sri Lanka to work for pennies an hour rather than dollars an hour. And so the Iraqis are resentful of this. You add all that up and you got a bunch of pissed off Iraqis. And they're looking at us going, why are you doing this to our country?
It sounds like New Orleans to me.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's the piece I wrote
about what's going on in this nation and how they destroyed this nation. I don't want to hear Bush or any other Republican talking about finding democracy somewhere else, and they're destroying it here.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the piece I wrote for Common Dreams today, the central focus of it was the neocon remapping and rewriting of the economic policies in Iraq. And I pointed out that on a smaller scale, this is exactly what they did in New Orleans as well. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Oh, man. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, it's not just the water, it's in the media. You know, and speaking of being news malnourished by our corporate media, which Ray McGovern referenced, you know, I noticed that even on the anniversary of 9/11, you yourself have yet to have had that promised serious discussion on that political crime and cover-up. So I have to assume that somehow you've yet to find this liar on the right to present the move on, nothing to see here.
You're absolutely right. We are working with the folks at 911truth.org in trying to find somebody who will come on to highlight these issues in a way that, you know, some kind of rational discussion. And they have been unable to find anybody. I have been unable to find anybody. We're still looking. And if anybody knows of anybody, David, you know, my producer, his email's over on our website, let us know. Let us know, because I would love to do that show. Ed in Portland, Oregon. Hey, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. You know, just to follow up on the tale of the last two callers with regards to Scott, you know, in addition to killing people and blowing things up, the other thing the military does is lie. You know, it's called a ruse of war when they want to deceive the enemy. And the thing is, there are certain generals in our military, certain people in uniform, that conceive of the American people as the enemy and view us as subject that they can do propaganda, psychological operations and stuff. And you know, the thing is that after Vietnam, after Iran-Contra, anybody that thinks that generals don't lie, you know, is just not paying attention.
Yeah, well said. Thank you very much. Tim, driving in Texas. Hey, Tim.
Yes, sir. First of all, on General Petraeus, one thing, why is it that anybody representing the Bush administration does not have to take an oath when they testify before Congress? I remember watching other generals when they testify before Congress, always taking an oath, you know, just like everybody else.
Yeah, and I mean, it used to be pretty routine, but ever since the Bushies came in, they pretty much stopped doing that.
That's right. Number two, nobody asked them the hard questions about how do you come up with the numbers of reduction when the GAO comes out and says, in effect, what you're doing, you're using now a new definition. If you're shot in the back of the head, that's terrorist. If you're shot in the front of the head, oh, that's just a normal crime.
Right. Yeah, they are cooking the books big time. You're right, Tim, and it's a terrible thing. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, we just have a few seconds before we have to wrap this show.
I'm going to leave you on a lamenting note after seeing what the Democratic Congress has been doing in terms of just seemingly not listening to us. You know, it reminded me of the arguments, the complaints over the last few years of Black Americans, how, you know, people said that, you know, they felt like they haven't been listened to because the response is like, okay, so.
Right. And the bottom line, the answer to all of this, Len, is that we all have to speak up louder, and we have to get out there and we have to get involved. I'm sorry. Complaining is not going to cut it. Not on this program. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Norman Podhartz on his new book, World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism. Conservative Joseph Farah from World End Daily is here asking, where's the fence? I'll be calming him down. In Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Corey Powell with Discover Magazine is here about, is science going away? Plus your calls and the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.